Today we'll consider Luke chapter 1 verses 5 through 23, which reads as follows. In the days of King Herod of Judea, there was a priest named Zechariah, who belonged to the priestly order of Abijah. His wife was a descendant of Aaron, and her name was Elizabeth. Both of them were righteous before God, living blamelessly according to all the commandments and regulations of the Lord. But they had no children, because Elizabeth was barren, and both were getting on in years. Once when he was serving as priest before God and his section was on duty, he was chosen by lot, according to the custom of the priesthood, to enter the sanctuary of the Lord and offer incense. Now at the time of the incense offering, the whole assembly of the people was praying outside. Then there appeared to him an angel of the Lord standing at the right side of the altar of incense. When Zechariah saw him, he was terrified and fear overwhelmed him. But the angel said to him, "Do not be afraid, Zechariah, for your prayer has been heard. Your wife Elizabeth will bear you a son, and you will name him John. You will have joy and gladness, and many will rejoice at his birth, for he will be great in the sight of the Lord. He must never drink wine or strong drink. Even before his birth, he will be filled with the Holy Spirit. He will turn many of the people of Israel to the Lord their God. With the spirit and power of Elijah, he will go before him to turn the hearts of parents to their children and the disobedient to the wisdom of the righteous, to make ready a people prepared for the Lord." Zechariah said to the angel, "How will I know that this is so? For I'm an old man, and my wife is getting on in years." The angel replied, "I am Gabriel. I stand in the presence of God, and I have been sent to speak to you and to bring you this good news. But now, because you did not believe my words, which will be fulfilled in their time, you will become mute, unable to speak until the day these things occur." Meanwhile, the people were waiting for Zechariah and wondered at his delay in the sanctuary. When he did come out, he could not speak to them, and they realized that he had seen a vision in the sanctuary. He kept motioning to them and remained unable to speak. When his time of service was ended, he went to his home. The writer of Ecclesiastes, whom the text calls the teacher, has written the following in Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verses 8 through 9. "All things are wearisome, more than one can express. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, or the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done. There is nothing new under the sun." In these verses, the teacher has made two observations. The first is that humans thirst endlessly for things fresh, new, and different. The eye will never see enough, and the ear will never hear enough. Second, the teacher has not proclaimed this to be an evil or wicked state. He has simply labeled it wearisome, for two reasons. The hunger for new and different is never satisfied, and it's an empty pursuit because there's nothing new under the sun. If novelty is the rabbit that humanity instinctively chases, then the experience of the teacher was that we are, in fact, running in circles. In his words, "What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done. There is nothing new under the sun." Now, as gloomy as that observation might be, there is hope to be found in it. The good news is that God repeats himself. The cycles of creation and the patterns of our lives are repetitive for our good. It's the very routineness of the patterns of our lives that allows us the stability to walk with confidence in the world. The stability of the so-called laws of nature are one example of this repetitiveness. If gravity, for instance, became irregular and spontaneous, who would have the confidence to step outside one's house? The human thirst for new and different feeds a curiosity in us that often leads to invention, innovation, and discovery. So in some ways, our insatiability has its positive outcomes. And yet, even indulging in this curiosity is only possible because so much of life is full of endless repetition. To say it another way, an erratic universe would not be discoverable, traversable, or even knowable. And this is true not only in the realm of the material universe, but in the spiritual as well. Just as nature depends on an endless cycle of repetition, so too do we in God's communications with us. The story of God's revelation to Zechariah is full of repetition. To quote again the teacher of Ecclesiastes, there is nothing new under the sun. To begin, Zechariah was a priest, and his wife Elizabeth was descended from the high priestly line of Moses' brother Aaron. The life of a priest was one of endless repetition. In his commentary on Luke's Gospel, Grant Osborne has described the priestly cycles as follows. There were about 18,000 priests at this time, divided into 24 divisions, named after Aaron's descendants, as can be seen in 1 Chronicles chapter 24, 1 through 31. Each one with several orders consisting of 8 or 9 families each. Each priestly division was responsible for supplying the priests in the temple complex for 2 weeks a year. Those who served were chosen by lot. Zechariah was chosen to serve in the holy place, and it's likely that this was the only time in his life, due to the thousands of priests, he had been privileged to do so. He is burning incense during the afternoon offering, called the Tamid. Incense was offered on the altar of incense in the holy place during the morning and evening sacrifices at 9 in the morning and 3 in the afternoon. That's the end of the quotation. In offering incense in the holy place, just outside of the Holy of Holies, Zechariah was following a ritualized pattern that had been established around 1,400 years earlier when God first offered the covenant of Sinai to Israel through Moses. More priests than can be counted had stood precisely where he was standing and had done precisely what he was doing every day of every year for over a millennium. What has been is what will be. And what has been done is what will be done. There is nothing new under the sun. And the repetition continues. Zechariah and Elizabeth were advanced in age and infertile. That too was an experience common to significant individuals throughout the history of Israel. We might recall that the father and mother of the Israelite people themselves, Abraham and Sarah, also were advanced in age and infertile when God promised them a child, their son Isaac. And Isaac's wife Rebekah was infertile as well, until God intervened in the conception of their twin sons Jacob and Esau. And Jacob's wife Rachel was infertile, until God intervened by allowing her to conceive their son Joseph. Centuries later, a man named Manoah and his wife were also infertile, and God sent an angel to them who promised them they would have a child, their son Samson. Even more, in 1 Samuel, we've been told the story of Hannah and Elkanah. In that instance, Hannah was Elkanah's second wife. His first wife had given birth to several children, but Hannah was infertile. God, too, through the high priest Eli, promised them a child, their son Samuel, who became a prophet and judge over Israel. This pattern of God is so pronounced in the history of Israel that the psalmist praised God for it in Psalm 113:9 when he wrote, "He gives the barren woman a home, making her the joyous mother of children. Praise the Lord." Again, what has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done. There is nothing new under the sun. As we continue, both Zechariah and Elizabeth were said to be righteous before God, living blamelessly according to all the commandments and regulations of the Lord. That has been a rare accolade, but not unprecedented in the history of Israel. God required this blamelessness of Abraham in Genesis chapter 17, verse 1, and the descriptions of Job in Job 1:1 and 1:8 are nearly identical to that of Zechariah and Elizabeth. And later in the New Testament, the Apostle Paul would say the following about his life in Judaism. He says, "As to righteousness under the law, blameless," speaking of himself. And again, "What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done. There is nothing new under the sun." The angel who appeared to Zechariah gave their name as Gabriel. An angel by this same name visited the prophet Daniel in Daniel chapter 8, verse 16 and chapter 9, verse 21. The command that Zechariah's son must never drink wine or strong drink was given by an angel to Samson's mother in Judges chapter 13, verse 7. And it was promised by Hannah on behalf of her son Samuel in 1 Samuel chapter 1, verse 11. And the commission given to Zechariah's son had already been prophesied by the prophet Malachi in Malachi chapter 4, verses 5 through 6, which reads as follows. Lo, I will send you the prophet Elijah before the great and terrible day of the Lord comes. He will turn the hearts of parents to their children, and the hearts of children to their parents, so that I will not come and strike the land with a curse. Yet again, what has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done. There is nothing new under the sun. Given all this repetition, perhaps we should not be surprised that in responding to Gabriel's message, Zechariah fell into a patterned response as well. When God had first told Abraham that he would give him a child born of Sarah, Abraham replied as follows. Then Abraham fell on his face and laughed, and said to himself, "Can a child be born to a man who is 100 years old? Can Sarah, who is 90 years old, bear a child?" That's Genesis chapter 17, verse 17. Zechariah responded similarly when he asked, "How will I know that this is so? For I'm an old man, and my wife is getting on in years." As repetitive as God is in his communications with us, and as full of repeated patterns as the chronicle of Gabriel's coming to Zechariah has been, something unexpected happened. God had not disciplined Abraham for his doubt that an old man and woman long past childbearing age could conceive a child. Nonetheless, Zechariah was chastised for his doubt. We find this in Luke 1, verse 19. The angel replied, "I am Gabriel. I stand in the presence of God, and I've been sent to speak to you and to bring you this good news. But now, because you did not believe my words, which will be fulfilled in their time, you will become mute, unable to speak, until the day these things occur." Why the different responses to Abraham and to Zechariah respectively? A key to understanding this difference is the repetition itself. In this encounter with Gabriel, Zechariah was surrounded by the history of Israel, being repeated in his immediate experience. All of the allusions to events in the history of Israel that we've already mentioned were being realized right in front of him. Stories that he, as a priest, had read and studied all his life were becoming realities. The promise of God to Abraham and Sarah and the others, the visitation of the angel Gabriel to Daniel, along with the fear that Zechariah felt when he encountered the angel, the proclamation of the coming fulfillment of the prophecies of Malachi, and on and on. Furthermore, Zechariah was a priest, serving God in the temple, and offering incense in the holy place, just outside the Holy of Holies, where God had promised to make his presence manifest. God speaks to and interacts with humans in consistent and repeated ways. God does this for our education and for our maturation. The scriptures insist that there are spiritual beings in the heavens other than the Lord our God. And the Apostle Paul, for instance, has taught us in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verses 12 to 15, to be wary of their penchant for pretending to be messengers from God. Paul wrote the following, "And what I do, I will also continue to do, in order to deny an opportunity to those who want an opportunity to be recognized as our, the apostles' equals, in what they boast about. For such boasters are false apostles, deceitful workers, disguising themselves as apostles of Christ. And no wonder, even Satan disguises himself as an angel of light. So it is not strange if his ministers also disguise themselves as ministers of righteousness. Their end will match their deeds." If God were spontaneous, interacting with his people in diverse ways and saying things to one person which contradicts something he has said before to another, how would we ever know what was truly from God and what was not? Spontaneity is unreliable. Constancy builds confidence. The repetitiveness over which the teacher of Ecclesiastes lamented is a gift to life on earth. God's repetitiveness is the foundation of our faith in his prophets and apostles. Abraham did not know God when God first called him to leave Ur and follow him to the land of Canaan. Abraham's life was, in part, a journey to come to know the God who called him and whom he followed. In this context, Abraham's doubt as to the ability of this God to make an elderly woman conceive is reasonable. It had never before been done in Abraham's experience, so Abraham doubted. Zechariah, however, was not in the same situation as Abraham. Zechariah was a priest in the household of Israel. Zechariah was an inheritor of at least 1,400 years of writing, preservation, and interpretation of the prophetic tradition of Israel, which included the story of Abraham. Though no one can know God completely, Zechariah knew a lot more about God than Abraham did when God first made the promise of a son to him. Even more, God brought a significant number of the scriptural narratives to life right before Zechariah's eyes that day in the holy place. And if that were not enough, God sent the angel Gabriel to appear to Zechariah in the holy place itself. Zechariah was not out on a walk, nor was he in a cave or on the top of a random mountain. Zechariah was in the midst of the holiest area of the temple itself. Why did he not believe? Somehow Zechariah had forgotten. Somehow Zechariah had failed to recognize the way the scriptures might have helped him to interpret the moment in which he found himself. Somehow Zechariah forgot that God can best be known by his consistency and his constancy. Despite all the signs which surrounded him in that moment, Zechariah wanted another sign to be certain that this promise was from God. Now, before we judge Zechariah too harshly, we should consider why he might have forgotten. We recall that the last recognized prophet of God among the people of Israel had died 400 years prior to Zechariah's encounter with the angel Gabriel. 400 years of silence is no small span of time. It's most likely that neither Zechariah himself nor anyone in living memory had ever encountered a messenger of God in this way. Perhaps it's not surprising that Zechariah questioned the truthfulness of his encounter. Now, of course, Zechariah had the scriptures, and had he thought about the stories, he would have likely picked up as many, if not more, allusions to the Old Testament than we have. But after centuries of God's silence and hiddenness, those stories probably came to feel less real to the people of Israel. And that's not to say that Zechariah would have come to believe them to be false. But it's quite easy to believe that what happened in the distant past is over and done with and unlikely to be repeated. What all of us must remember is that long periods of God's silence are as repetitive as the patterns which God follows when he speaks and acts in history. The Bible is full of long gaps between one communication of God and another, some of those gaps much longer than the 400 years between the life of the last Hebrew prophet and the birth of John the Baptist. We ourselves have lived over 1,900 years since the death of the last of Jesus' apostles. What the experience of Zechariah reminds us in part is that however long God has been silent, God will speak again. Additionally, when God does speak, he will speak repetitively. In other words, when God speaks, he will speak consistently with what he has said before. He will call our attention to the events recorded by the people of Israel in the scriptures, and the promises, warnings, or callings that he proclaims will be consistent with those he has proclaimed in the past. One final test of authenticity remains, however. Whatever God says will prove true. When God sent Moses to confront Pharaoh on behalf of Israel, we find the following exchange in Exodus chapter 3, verses 10 through 12. The text says, "So come, I'll send you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt." But Moses said to God, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt?" He, God, said, "I will be with you, and this shall be the sign for you that it is I who sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall worship God on this mountain." The final confirmation of God's truthfulness comes after the fact. What God says will, in the end, be accomplished. Of course, that is a confirmation that Zechariah would have to wait to receive. What God expected of Zechariah was not certainty, but faith. The writer of the Epistle to the Hebrews has defined faith as follows. This is Hebrews chapter 11, verse 1. Now faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. And James, in the Epistle of James, has added to that definition more clarity in James chapter 2, verses 14 to 17, which says, "What good is it, my brothers and sisters, if you say you have faith, but do not have works? Can faith save you? If a brother or sister is naked and lacks daily food, and one of you says to them, 'Go in peace, keep warm, and eat your fill,' and yet you do not supply their bodily needs, what is the good of that? So faith by itself, if it has no works, is dead." To put these two teachings together, faith is trust to act, which is rooted in the consistency of what is being required. Because of the consistency of God's repeated patterns, the speaking of God should be no mystery to the people of God. At the very least, Zechariah should have trusted Gabriel's message because of the consistency by which it came to him. Furthermore, there was nothing in Gabriel's message that required any action or belief on Zechariah's part that was not already required of him by the scriptural testimonies themselves. Zechariah was not being asked to believe something that had not occurred before. He was not being asked to do anything that was not already part of the life of the people of Israel, and he was not being asked to say anything that God had not already asked others to speak. Zechariah's doubt was unacceptable to God because it revealed a lack of trust in all that had come before him. In this moment, Zechariah stood with the skeptics, described later by the Apostle Peter in 2 Peter chapter 3, verses 2 through 4. First of all, you must understand this, that in the last days scoffers will come, scoffing and indulging their own lusts, and saying, "Where is the promise of his coming? For ever since our ancestors died, all things continue as they were from the beginning of creation." If we are ever to recognize God speaking today, we must remember all that God has said and done in the past. And the past recollections, of which we can be most certain, are those which God breathed and God preserved in the scriptures of the chosen people of Israel, the prophets and the apostles. The scriptures have been preserved for us not only so that we might remember the past, and not even so that we might merely remember what the past means, though they do both of those things. As we discussed in our last exploration, God breathed and preserved the scriptures so that we might come to know him, maybe even more, so that we might come to recognize him. The scriptures prepare us for God speaking today by providing us with the patterns of God speaking to them. Let us learn from the example of Zechariah that we are responsible to remember all that God has said and done. The ignorance that defended Abraham will not defend us who have been given his story. When God speaks consistently and repetitively that we might know who speaks to us and how we are to respond. May we study the scriptures well enough to recognize God if he chooses to speak to us. May those who have ears to hear listen to what the Spirit is saying to the churches. Amen.